Hi, everybody. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast of Labor Relations Information System. I am your host, Rick Polson. I'm the executive director of LRIS. I'm also a labor lawyer with the firm of Willig, Williams & Davidson in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Welcome back, everybody, for another month's worth of discussions of issues that are legal issues that are of importance to public safety unions and public safety managers. A little bit of a departure for us this month. Normally, you know, we're going to go through three or four recent cases of interest, and those are cases that we highlight. Usually, we're going to highlight in our public safety labor news newsletter. You can, if you want to sign up for that, you can check all that out at www.lrs.com. But this month, I want to talk about one case in particular. It's a case that was argued before the U.S. Supreme Court just this week. I'm recording this on March the 4th. The case was argued on March the 2nd of 2026. It's called United States versus Hamani. It is a case that deals with guns and drugs, right? Two of our favorite subjects, guns and drugs. We're going to talk about it. And, you know, the reason we're talking about this is because for public safety personnel, and particularly public safety personnel who have to carry guns, right? So police officers, correctional officers, not so much for fire and EMS personnel, but certainly we have, you know, folks there, right? You put the red pill and the blue pill fire investigations. But for folks who have to carry guns, it's been pretty easy to prohibit those employees' otherwise lawful use of marijuana if they happen to be in a state that has medical or recreational marijuana use. In a sense, you're kind of treating folks as second-class citizens when it comes to otherwise lawful conduct. There aren't a lot of police unions that are banging down the doors saying, hey, we want our members to be able to use marijuana, and there's lots of obvious reasons for that. But the more and more we see and smell and experience marijuana in our day-to-day, the more this is becoming an issue, and I'm seeing lots of incidences where officers are testing positive, usually in random drug tests, it may relate to direct, marijuana use, but sometimes it's these CBD oils and creams, and maybe took a gummy by mistake, all these kind of things that are out there. So there's more opportunities for people to screw up, sometimes intentionally, sometimes unintentionally. At the agency level, it was always really easy to say, we've got a zero tolerance policy with respect to drug use, and especially, or not especially, but as it relates to marijuana, which is a Schedule I drug. It's a scheduled drug, and it's a Schedule I drug at the federal level. Maybe that will change, but as of right now, it's still a Schedule I drug. What agencies could always point to, or what certification agencies at the state level certifying an officer or a correctional officer could always point to, is the fact that being an active drug user and possessing a gun is a federal crime, right? So, if you have to use a gun for your job and you partake in marijuana, whether it's lawful, either recreationally or medicinally in the state that you live, it doesn't matter. You're committing a federal crime, and we're not going to let you do it. Easy peasy, end of story. Marijuana use is prohibited. It used to be that easy, kinda. That's a whole other episode about litigation related to that. But the reason that we're talking about the Hamani case is I think the rules are about to change, and they've changed over the last few years, but they're going to change, I think, in a significant way. So this month, it's guns and drugs. What do we do about it in public safety land? Stick around. Before we jump into the case and some of the background cases related to this issue, I did want to give a heads up on some stuff that we have going on at LRS this spring. We are going to get together in Nashville. We're actually just there in January. We're going to be back in Nashville at the Sonesta on April 15th, 16th, and 17th. So coming up, in a month for our collective bargaining seminar. It's going gangbusters, man. There are tons of people attending this thing from all over the country. Really excited for this one. This is a 2.5-day seminar, just a deep dive on all aspects of negotiations. We're going to have, folks who negotiate contracts. We're going to have financial experts who are involved in those things as well, just to kind of give their perspectives. Great thing about this is we have union side negotiators, management side negotiators. So if you're interested in that, check that out at lrs.com/seminars. And for our law enforcement folks, our annual rights of police officer seminar will be back in Las Vegas, June 17th to the 19th. We're going to be at the Horseshoe in the Paris in Vegas. It's a really great setup there. And that is soup to nuts, you know, statutory rights, constitutional rights, AI, Brady Giglio, some of this drug stuff, you know, that we're going to talk about today, discipline, bargaining, all of the various rights, this bundle of rights that affect police officers and police agencies. You know, that's what we talk about for 2.5 days there. Really great seminar. If you're interested in that, check it out. I think that's about it. See you soon. Okay. Guns and drugs, drugs and guns. Let's talk about this case, U.S. v. Hamani. You know, I know you're like, Rick, please tell us the docket number. It's the Supreme Court docket number 24-1234. Now you know, you're so happy. Case was just argued in court Monday of this week, so March 2nd of 2026. It was argued, and this is a criminal case. It's a criminal appeal. Case comes out of Texas. The defendant in that case, his name is Ali. I don't know where it's Daniel or Daniel Hamani. We're going to call him Hamani from now on. He's from Texas. His home gets searched by the FBI in sometime in 2022. As a result of the search, the agents found a gun, a Glock, a 9mm pistol, about 60 grams of marijuana, and almost 5 grams of cocaine. That's a lot of cocaine. Hamani, during the investigation, admitted that he used marijuana roughly every other day, and he did acknowledge that the cocaine was his. So pretty straightforward case here, right? You know, he's indicted in February 2023 for violating Section 922 G3 of the Federal Crimes Code, and that is essentially the law, we're going to talk about this, that makes it a felony for a, quote, unlawful user, unquote, or someone addicted to a controlled substance to possess a firearm. So if you're an unlawful user of a controlled substance and you possess a firearm, congratulations, you committed a federal crime. And the government indicted Hamani in February 2023 for that reason. The only charge that they brought against him was that he possessed a gun while he was an unlawful drug user. The prosecutors in that case didn't allege that he was high, that he was intoxicated at the time, just that he possessed drugs and he possessed a gun. There were no other like terrorism or drug dealing charges that could have potentially been brought. So the case is really straightforward. It's just this one charge. So he's indicted. And what happens? You know, Hamani moves to dismiss the indictment, arguing that the gun charge, the gun and drug and charge brought against him, violated his Second Amendment right under what we call the historical tradition test that was set forth in a Supreme Court case called New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin. That case was decided in 2022. If you're saying, Rick, I have no idea what that case is or what the rule is or what the historical tradition test is, don't worry. I'm going to tell you what it is just in a few minutes. So hang on. So Hamani says, you got to dismiss this thing. This charge brought against me violates my Second Amendment rights. And the district court agreed with him and dismissed the charges as an unconstitutional violation of Hamani's Second Amendment rights. The court noted in its decision that Hamani was a habitual marijuana user, but he was not actively under the influence when he possessed the gun. And therefore, you know, his case was outside of any traditional basis for disarmament that might have existed. So he had the drugs. He was not intoxicated, though, at the time that he was arrested. The government appealed the dismissal to the Fifth Circuit, the federal appellate court circuit in that part of the country. And the Fifth Circuit confirmed the dismissal on appeal. The government then asked the Supreme Court to take an appeal of that case, and the Supreme Court did take the appeal. That's weird. Why does the Supreme Court take the appeal? They don't take every appeal, right? There has to be something unusual going on. In this case, there was a split in the federal circuits over exactly this question, exactly this part of the federal crime code. We're going to talk a little bit about that split. But the court took the case in October of 2025. It was briefed and it was just argued this week. And the issue before the court was Does the federal law that prohibits the possession of firearms by a person who is a, quote, unlawful user of or addicted to any controlled substance, close quote, violate the respondent's Second Amendment right to bear arms? So that's the case that made its way up to the Supreme Court. It's an interesting case. You know, the fun thing about Supreme Court cases, there's so much transparency around these cases. There's lots of attention to them. There are a million different sites, including the Supreme Court's own, you know, webpage, where you can go and you can see every brief filed by every party in the case. When we have cases in the Supreme Court, for those of you who may not know, and this is true in your state appellate courts and in other cases, we'll have briefs submitted by the parties, right? You know, so it's Coke versus Pepsi. Each side files a brief. You know, here it was Hamani, the defendant, and then the government. Those are the two parties in the criminal case. But when cases work their way up the appellate ladder, you can have other groups, friends of the court, they're called, who can file briefs saying, listen, we're not parties in the case, but we're kind of have an opinion, you know, about the issues that this case affects. And we might have some area of expertise that could be helpful to the court in reaching its decision. So, you know, please consider our arguments on this case. And when you look at Supreme Court case, there's tons of friends of the court briefs that are submitted. And I always like to look at like who's on which side. This case is so interesting in this issue, this guns and drugs case, right? So you have a clash between gun rights and drug rights. You get all kinds of wacky groups. So the gun rights groups, the defendant in this case has both the ACLU and the NRA on the defendant side. When does that ever happen, right? Strange bedfellows. And then the gun control groups are with the government, are with the Trump administration and the gun control groups on the same side in this case. So it's really interesting, the strange bedfellows that the case you know, has given us. And that happens sometimes, but this is a particularly interesting one. You know, when are we going to get a decision? Well, we're going to talk more about the arguments, but we're going to expect to see a decision this summer, right? Probably around May, June, something like that, that should clarify questions about this 2022 test that the Supreme Court set for gun rights that has caused a ton of problems in the courts over the last few years. And it's also going to kind of flesh out the rights of, you know, people who use marijuana in a lawful manner as it relates to the federal criminal code. Question you may be asking yourself is, well, why the heck do I care? You know, if I'm a police officer or a firefighter or a correctional officer or a lawyer or an HR person, you know, working in and around this is, well, you should care because, as I mentioned earlier, you know, this section of the crimes code that, you know, makes it a crime, you know, for somebody to be an active user of a controlled substance and possess a gun at the same time. That's been the biggest reason why law enforcement agencies have been able to prohibit the use of marijuana, otherwise lawful marijuana use by members of their agencies. And as that spreads, right, you know, half the country, it basically is recreational marijuana at this point, a lot more, you know, medicinal marijuana. That trend is not going to change, right? Is it good public policy? No, it's crazy. This is my expert opinion as one person, by the way, but I think it's insane, right? The expansion of marijuana and the increased access of marijuana. That said, nobody cares what I think. So it's happening. There's a ton of money behind it, you know, both for private industry and government coffers when they tax the hell out of it, and they do. So it's going to happen. If you're in a state that prohibits recreational and medicinal, that's probably going to change soon. If you're in a medical state, I'm in Pennsylvania, it's a medical marijuana state, that's going to be recreational soon. And if you're a recreational state, you know, it's kind of all bets are off, right? And so this is happening. And so we have to make sure that our drug testing policies or rules in a negotiated setting have realistic rules, you know, for folks. And again, it's not just somebody saying, well, why shouldn't I have be able to take a gummy if, you know, if anyone else can. It's also the unintentional stuff. There's so many unregulated, you know, CBD products out there that are going to result in people testing hot that we have to, you know, get out front of it. And the thing that makes it doubly interesting here, we don't just have questions regarding, you know, somebody saying, look, man, I'm a citizen. Right. If I have a right to have a beer, just like anybody else, so long as I don't show up to work intoxicated, why can't I do that with marijuana if I live in a recreational marijuana state? Or if I'm eligible for medical marijuana. Well, gee, why might a public safety employee, you know, be eligible for treatment with marijuana? You know, I could say cannabis or anything else, but you know what I'm talking about. Well, you know, we all know marijuana is really, really useful treatment. At least there's lots of science behind it for PTS and for anxiety. And so we've got a category of employees that are particularly susceptible to PTS and related, you know, traumas. And we have medicine, you know, that is proven to help with that, that you can't take. And those are the cases where, you know, they're really troubling. We have, and I've been in this situation where you have somebody whose doc is saying, you know, I want to prescribe medicinal marijuana to you. I think it's going to be the best treatment for you for this course of conduct. And the employee says, I can't do it. You know, I'm not allowed to take that medicine. I have to take some second best medicine that may not work as well because I'm prohibited from using marijuana because I'm a law enforcement officer. And if you dig down to the bottom of that and you say, why are you prohibited? The agency is generally going to come back and say, well, you know, if you're a marijuana user and you carry a gun, you committed a federal crime. That's it. So, you know, that's why, you know, the law or the development of the law around this section of the criminal code is so important to public safety personnel. So what law are we talking about? The federal criminal code, and specifically section 922, and specifically section 922 D3 and G3 are the sections that are most important. So 922 D3 makes it unlawful to sell or otherwise dispose of any firearm or ammunition to any person who is a quote unlawful user of or addicted to any controlled substance. The one that's really applicable here is section 922 G3, which prohibits any such unlawful user from possessing or receiving any firearm or ammunition, blah, 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 blah. All right. So G3, right? If I'm a quote unquote unlawful user of marijuana or really any controlled substance, but if I'm in here, we're talking about marijuana. If I'm an unlawful user of marijuana and I possess a firearm, I've committed a federal crime. All right. Well, what's an unlawful user? Where it gets kind of dicey. You know, the federal government has used a really, really, really expansive definition of unlawful user, you know, for decades. And this stems, it goes back to ATF rules that were issued in 1997 that they'll use to process firearms applications. Basically the definition is you're an unlawful user of a controlled substance if you have used the substance once within the past year. That's the rule, right? So one time within the past year, you are an unlawful user of that controlled substance. And to quote the actual reg, you know, it's quote, use is prohibited when within the past year, the person has had a drug conviction for using or possessing, has admitted to using or possessing, or has had any positive drug test or was convicted of a misdemeanor crime involving drugs. All right. In that is if you use a controlled substance once within the past year, you are an unlawful user. How often does that come up? Just to give you some numbers on, firearm applications, you know, the ATF's review of those things, almost 9,000 times in FY, the federal government's FY25 reporting on this, it's 8,800 times ATF denied a firearm application for being in violation, the person being in violation of the drug user gun ban. Half the time, 49% of those denials, about 4,300 denials, were based on a single use, or at least inference of a single use in the application, right? So this comes up a lot. So it's not a rule that just exists on paper. It's a rule that ATF applies, and it's a rule that the federal government's going to use when they're determining whether somebody has violated Section 922 G3. So if you used it once in the last year, you are an unlawful user. All right, keep that in the back of your head. You know, the issue therefore becomes a problem if you are somebody who has been prescribed marijuana. Right. You know, or if you recreationally use marijuana, and let's say you've never once been intoxicated, you've never once been impaired by it, you still are in violation of 922 G3, I'd say on its face as interpreted by ATF for the last 30 years. Okay. So we've got a violation here. If that law, however, is unconstitutional, right? It's not enforceable against you, then I guess you're not engaging in any criminal activity. And then we have to ask ourselves then, well, why are you then prohibited from engaging in this otherwise lawful conduct? Again, in your state, depending on what your state has to say about this. This is why the rules are, these cases that have developed over the last few years regarding the Second Amendment are so important. And, you know, why do I say the last few years? I say the last few years because the rules with respect to Second Amendment rights changed, whether intentionally or unintentionally. They changed pretty significantly in 2022 when the Supreme Court struck down a concealed carry law from New York City. It was one of those May issue concealed carry laws. So like the default wasn't that, you know, that you get to carry a concealed weapon. Basically, you had to, you know, submit an application, you know, and say, here's why, you know, I'm a pizza delivery person, or I'm a this, that, or the other thing. And that's why I need to have the ability to carry a concealed weapon for self-defense. You know, the vast majority of these applications are just like, they're granted anyway, right? But a group, you know, brought a lawsuit deliberately challenging New York City's concealed carry law, arguing that you know, inappropriately restricted their rights under the Second Amendment. Why did somebody or why did a group choose to challenge that? Because the current Supreme Court is generally regarded as pro-gun. Or I'd say maybe they're not pro-gun, but they're pro-Second Amendment. And the court's jurisprudence on Second Amendment issues, you know, over the last really, honestly, quite frankly, over the last 30 years, you know, it's not this court, it's a number of courts, has gradually strengthened individual rights under the Second Amendment. Way back when I was in law school a million years ago, the Supreme Court hadn't ever identified an individual's right to bear arms under the Second Amendment. That was reviewed as a collective right, you know, essentially referring to the rights of a local militia or something like that under the Constitution. Those days are gone, right? The court, you know, has since made very clear that every individual has a right to bear arms under the Second Amendment. Now, that can be regulated, that can be limited, right? That's what the court does, you know, is apply the Constitution to limitations. But this is an individual right. This court is loath to limit those rights. And so in this case, this Chan, that's why, you know, that's what groups do. Interest groups line up good facts, good case to try to bring to a court that they think is going to get them the outcome they want. That's fair play, man. That's how the process works. And so we have a group that funds, that fines and funds a lawsuit challenging this May Carry Law out of New York City. They don't want to win, right? They want to lose. They want to appeal, and they want that case to go all the way up to the Supreme Court. They want the Supreme Court to take it. The court did that. And the court struck down New York City's concealed carry law. In the decision, you know, what the Supreme Court does is they decide cases, right? And then they are supposed to, you know, as the highest court in the land, provide guidance for lower courts on how to deal with similar issues in the future, right? They may set a new test. They may set new rules. They may, in their explanations as to why they took the actions they took, provide guidance, or sometimes it's not guidance, it's, you know, a requirement, it's mandatory guidance on lower courts on how to interpret similar questions. And so in this particular case, the court laid down a new test for Second Amendment cases. And that test was that if a regulation, if some type of government regulation restricts conduct covered by the Second Amendment, the government has to justify the regulation by proving that it aligns with historical firearm laws rather than relying on contemporary policy concerns. So you got to get in the Wayback Machine. You got to go back to when the Second Amendment was written, and that wasn't like last Tuesday, right? It was a while ago or a couple hundred years ago. And, you know, try to identify what the founders, what the drafters of the amendment intended to protect or to protect against when they drafted that. And, you know, so what's important is what were the firearms laws in effect in the 1790s? That's essentially what the court was saying. And if the new law goes outside of those bounds, it goes outside of what the court would call the historical tradition with respect to these types of regulations, then we have a constitutional violation. We call that the historical tradition test. You know, what happened after that case was decided was the floodgates opened, right? So almost immediately after the court decided Bruin, people started raising challenges left and right to, you name it, any type of firearm regulation that's out there was now subject to challenge, because somebody would say, well, if this didn't exist back in 1790, you can't have it now. That's unconstitutional. And you know, where we really saw it raise its head was in the context of criminal convictions, and especially gun laws, right? And gun and drug laws. Anything, right? Any federal crime that in any way limited somebody's ability to possess a firearm. So there's any number of ways that possession of a firearm under certain circumstances, you know, can be a crime and is a crime. All of those laws, all of those prohibitions were suddenly in play because they're going to be challenged. If you're the defendant in a criminal case, you're going to raise every possible freaking defense and challenge that you can to keep your ass out of jail, right? That's what you're going to do. And so every defendant in every gun case in every part of the country immediately challenged any convictions that they had on the basis that the federal law that they were prosecuted under was unconstitutional, right? So that's like, you know, full employment for lawyers, lots of work for lawyers. I'm not sure that that's what the court intended. Who the heck knows? There's some signals maybe in subsequent cases that that is not what the court intended, but the floodgates are open. And what happens then is the court is called to decide one of these challenges to federal gun laws. And the court issued a decision in a case called United States versus Rahimi 2 years later in 2024. Now, that case was a challenge to a different section of the federal crimes code. So we're here talking about 922G2 or 3, I forget already. It's been such a long podcast. But we're talking about 922G8 in Rahimi, and that's the section of the crime codes that prohibits gun possession by individuals subject to a domestic violence protection order, right? Boy, talk about good facts, right? So this case makes its way to the Supreme Court, meaning who's going to go out there and fight for the rights of people who abuse their spouses, right? So like, if you're going to try to identify a case with troubling facts, maybe that's the case that you're going to raise. And the question that the court that made its way before the court in this 2024 case, it was argued in the fall of 23, was whether that section of the federal crimes code, which prohibits the possession of firearms by persons subject to domestic violence restraining orders, violates the Second Amendment on its face. What did you think the Supreme Court was going to do? Issue a decision? People say it's going to be invalidated. You know, absolutely. You know, the Supreme Court is really serious on gun issues. And lots of commentators were saying, this is an example of the court's gone too far. And this is what can happen as a result of this historical tradition test. All kinds of conduct now, you know, criminal conduct is going to be normalized. The Supreme Court, you know, they're supposed to kind of call it like they see it. They're not supposed to think about outcomes. That's a whole other course that we can talk about. They're aware of outcomes, okay? And in this particular case, the court, not surprisingly, upheld the regulation, right? So it upheld what it called common sense firearm regulation and said, yeah, we get it. There's a historical tradition test, but it doesn't mean that every gun law or every criminal gun law is now unconstitutional. And to quote from the court's decision there, and I think they aptly and ably kind of described the facts in that case, but here, quote, when an individual poses a clear threat of physical violence to another, the threatening individual may be disarmed. Since the founding, our nation's firearm laws have included provisions preventing individuals who threaten physical harms to others from being from misusing firearms. And, you know, the ultimate holding there was that court stated that an individual found by a court to pose a credible threat to the physical safety of another may be temporarily disarmed, consistent with the Second Amendment. Right. They frame it in a way that, of course, right. Is there any way we're going to rule otherwise? And so yes, this person has rights under the Second Amendment, but if we have a finding by a court that you pose a credible threat to the safety of another, yeah, you can be temporarily disarmed. That was the holding of Rahimi. And there was a bit in that decision, a bit of a blowback, I think, against some of the court's critics and some of the people who had taken maybe extreme positions in the wake of the New Test in Bruin. And so in dicta, that basically dicta is like extra stuff justices say at the end to say, and another thing. In dicta in Rahimi, the court says the following. Some courts have misunderstood the methodology of our recent Second Amendment cases. These precedents were not meant to suggest a law trapped in amber. The Second Amendment permits more than just those regulations identical to ones that could be found in 1791. Holding otherwise would be as mistaken as applying the protections of the right only to muskets and sabers. Right? So the court was kind of saying, listen, you know, we're not idiots. Okay, we want to look at what, you know, is the regulation similar, right, to regulations that existed in 1791? It doesn't have to be exact. They don't have to be identical. So maybe the court was acknowledging that it probably didn't set the clearest of rules in 2022. Bit of blowback there in 2024. Hopefully some guidance to the lower courts. Well, you know, Rahimi then upheld this law dealing with gun possession by, you know, wife beaters, basically, right? Well, what about the provision that we're talking about, right? You know, law dealing with gun possession by active drug users. Were there challenges to those convictions? Absolutely. Every single one, right? Everybody in the country who was convicted, of a crime or accused of a crime like that raised and challenged the constitutionality of that statute. Can you say Hunter Biden, right? I mean, like this is, you know, everybody raised these arguments. And there were a couple of cases where defendants did so successfully. And so a case that was pretty important was U.S. versus Patrick Darnell Daniels. It was decided by the Fifth Circuit in 2025. And this is, you know, kind of a run-of-the-mill drug gun case. He gets pulled over, he's driving without a license plate. You're not supposed to do that. Officers smell cannabis. They do a search. This is back when you could do a search based on the smell of cannabis. They find some cannabis butts in the ashtray and two loaded firearms, right? So he's arrested and he's charged. He admitted to being a regular consumer of cannabis. He wasn't intoxicated, though, at the time of the arrest, but he was charged with 922G3 and he was convicted by a jury. Daniels appealed and he appealed successfully. And the Fifth Circuit Court reversed his conviction, finding that the regulation, the provision of the code that he was convicted of violating was, quote, not consistent with our history and tradition of gun regulation. Here's what the court said, quote, our history and tradition may support some limits on an intoxicated person's right to carry a weapon, but it does not justify disarming a sober citizen based exclusively on his past drug use, nor do more generalized traditions of disarming dangerous persons support this restriction on nonviolent drug users. So the Fifth Circuit said, wait a minute, we have a guy with drugs and he's got guns, but he's not intoxicated. And I don't understand that to be consistent with our country's tradition, right, of disarming sober citizens. Unless you can show me that, I don't see it that way. The parties weren't, or the government wasn't able to show that particular panel of judges that. And so they invalidated the conviction. Pretty important case. And that's in the Fifth Circuit. And that's where the case that we're talking about today came out of. And so we'll talk about that in a few minutes. But this isn't just a Fifth Circuit thing. U.S. v. Cooper decided in the Eighth Circuit. Again, criminal case. We've got a 3-year conviction. Somebody stopped with a Glock and drugs. He admitted regular marijuana use, but he wasn't intoxicated at the time. He's convicted. And then the matter is dismissed on appeal, where the court noting that the prohibition on gun ownership by drug users is justified only in certain circumstances. Great quote from this case. Quote, even a frail and elderly grandmother who used marijuana for a chronic medical condition could not be, quote, in possession of a shotgun to defend her home under 922G3, right? So, you know, you see how courts are looking at this stuff. Another conviction overturned, another federal circuit The 11th Circuit, you know, same thing in Florida. Now, this case is interesting. It's Cooper v. Garland. This was decided by the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals last August. It was remanded for more action at the district court, and it's all kind of on hold now, pending the decision in the Supreme Court case that's currently at issue. But this wasn't a criminal case, which is why it's an interesting one. And so this was a challenge to brought by two people who were in Florida's medical marijuana program. Florida is medical marijuana, not recreational marijuana. You have to amend the Constitution of Florida to get that in place. There was an attempt in 2024 that it failed, but there's still, I think, 57 or 58% of voters voted for recreational marijuana. So even though they didn't reach the 60% threshold, it kind of shows you where the public is. So they'll probably be recreational at some point. So we have two people who were registered with the state medical marijuana program. And then you had a gun owner, right, who wanted to register for the program. Both chances, so it's two sides of the same, or different sides of the coin, brought a challenge saying that medical marijuana patients shouldn't be prohibited from firearm ownership solely, right, because they've chosen to treat an illness in a particular way. That challenge was dismissed at first, so they were unsuccessful in district court. But then in the summer of 2025, they were successful in the 11th Circuit, and the court said that the government failed to meet its burden to establish that disarming medical marijuana users is consistent with this nation's history and tradition of firearm regulation. Are you noticing a trend here in the circuits? One more case, U.S. v. Harrison from the 10th Circuit, also decided last summer. Same deal. Somebody blows a red light. Officer smells marijuana. We got a loaded gun in the car. Right, no guns in this country, by the way. Loaded gun in the car, we have a conviction, and we have an appeal, and a conviction overturned. And the court basically says here that, to determine whether or not 922G3 is applied in those cases was consistent with our nation's tradition, the government has to show that non-intoxicated marijuana users pose a risk of danger. Right. So, there's no dispute that this particular person wasn't intoxicated. So show me the danger that this person posed in this particular case. And it was remanded. There were some cases in some circuits that went the other way. And so that gives us what we call a split in circuits. The Seventh Circuit upheld 922G3, Third Circuit case that upheld it. But we've got these other cases that invalidated it. And so that meant the question was ripe for the Supreme Court. The Hamani case is the case that made its way up. By the way, that was the government's preferred case. The government kind of got its way there because there's cocaine in that case, right? There's cocaine involved in that case. And I think it was like, oh, maybe those are, more problematic facts than just a pure, pure is probably the wrong word, but just a marijuana case, right? Where it was just marijuana. But so the case that the government wanted is the one that went up to the court in Hamani. There were petitions filed in the Daniels case and in other cases, but all those things are just kind of placed on hold awaiting the decision in Hamani. So what's going on in Hamani? Well, I told you, basically what the outcomes were. But let me tell you some of the whys. And so, we got Hamani, right? They search, they get a warrant, they search his house, right? They find the guns, they find marijuana, they find cocaine. Not intoxicated, right? That's a fact in the case that Hamani wasn't intoxicated. The charges against Hamani were dismissed at the first level. So the district court dismissed charges against Hamani. The district court relied on the U.S. v. Daniels decision that we just talked about. Right. And that's the case that said that 922G3 was unconstitutional as applied to an admitted regular drug user who was not under the influence at the time of possessing a firearm. So the district court said, hey, I have a decision that was just actually had just been decided a couple months before. I'm bound by that. We're going to apply that rule. The government appealed, took it back up to the Fifth Circuit. And the Fifth Circuit said what it had just said a couple of months before in Daniels. And that's that 922G3 can be applied consistent with the Second Amendment only to those presently impaired by drugs or alcohol, not to sober habitual users. So in the Fifth Circuit's view, in that case, the historical tradition test wasn't met for a broad ban on drug users, right? Historical laws in evidence in that case did bar gun possession for folks who were actively intoxicated, but there was no founding era analog for disarming sober individuals, solely for frequent drug or alcohol use. A neat quote from Hamani's brief in the Supreme Court, I think sums it up. And it just says, look, there has never been a tradition in this country of stripping someone of gun rights merely for regular use of an intoxicant while sober. And that's true. And so, that's what happened. And that was the rationale applied in the Fifth Circuit. The case makes its way to the Supreme Court, right? It's the case that the government wanted the Supreme Court to consider. They argued it this week, and the government got hammered in argument. How do I know this? Because I listened to it. Wait, how are you able to listen to these things, Rick? It's all public. There's so much transparency around Supreme Court cases. And, if you've never done this, and, I don't expect you to spend your Friday night doing this like maybe I do, but go and listen to the Supreme Court argument. You can get it from the Supreme Court's webpage. There are a number of different sources out there. If you just Google listen to Supreme Court argument, if you Google Hamani Supreme Court argument, you're going to wind up in some website where you can listen to the arguments. And, for that case or any other case, I really recommend that you try it just once, to listen to that once. And I'll tell you why. If you listen to this podcast, or if you come to our seminars, or if you're one of my clients, and you've ever heard me talk about judges, I'm about as cynical as you possibly can be about judges and the judicial system, and judges, look, they're either elected, so they're absolutely politicians, or they're appointed, and people who get appointed as judges are politicians. They're politically active, and they all have their own biases and their ways of looking at things. And, I'm just not a huge fan of justice in the judicial system most days of the week. Or let's say that I'm a little cynical of it. And that's just one person's opinion. But when I listen to Supreme Court arguments, I am reminded of the strength of our judicial branch. Because if you read the news, the news story covering whatever Supreme Court decision that was issued, that's going to give you like the bottom line kind of outcome, but it's not really going to talk about what was argued or why or what the legal rules were. They're just going to give you, the final outcome. And the justices tend to become caricatures, especially when we live through, the process of appointing and vetting judges on the Supreme Court, which has become more and more contentious. You start to think, this justice is a jerk. This justice is in the bag. This justice doesn't know what she's talking about. This justice is, and I think a lot of people view the justices like that, as just, hey, they're a vote. That's a guaranteed vote. They're going to look at things my way. There could be a guy in the White House that thinks that way, but he's not the only one. And sometimes I can fall into the trap of thinking that way. And then I go and I read the briefs in cases that are submitted, not just the party briefs, but the, a brief or two submitted by friends of the court. And I see the quality of the arguments that are made, either side, opposing sides, both writing really convincing briefs, and legal arguments as to why their position is the correct one. And then when you listen to the justices challenge the lawyers, you can hear the Q&A, you hear the lawyers' presentations, and you hear, and these are some of the best lawyers in the country. And some of them are just nervous as hell. You can hear in their voice, and like, wow, you're so good. Why are you so nervous? And then the justices start asking them questions. And I've listened to a lot of arguments, and I've listened to arguments where I'm shaking my head, arguments where I'm like talking back to a justice, and not nicely, because I disagree with the position that they're taking. Right. But I've never heard a justice, question a lawyer in a Supreme Court argument and not come away impressed of like the breadth and depth of their knowledge of virtually every issue that comes before them. It really is extraordinary. So even the ones that you're like, oh, I hate that justice, or that justice is in the back, We're talking about really smart, really capable, really qualified, you know, jurists. And I think, you know, just as an American, it's good to listen to that once, just listen and hear. And it gives you a sense of, okay, well, these guys actually do know what they're talking about. And they ask really important questions. And it's healthy to hear that dialogue. And it is a little bit of a reminder that we are capable of doing that. You know, it's not just social media bullshit. We can have intelligent arguments about things. And so maybe this is the case that you use to listen. And, you know, like I said, the justices crushed the government in this case. I don't know what the outcome is going to be. And that's what happens. You hear argument, and I do cases, you do the argument, and then you wait a couple of months for the decision, and people just read the tea leaves and go, oh, what do you think? Well, Justice so-and-so scratched his nose. That means who the hell knows, right? But it is certainly interesting to hear the arguments. And so, you know, they're posed with this question of whether 922G3 prohibits gun possession, you know, only by somebody actually under the influence of drugs, right? That's what Hamani's saying, right? You can only apply this to somebody who's intoxicated. And the government's saying, no, we can apply this to somebody who habitually uses or regularly uses illegal drugs, even when they're not intoxicated. That's the crux of the case. When you listen to the argument, you can kind of get a sense of where the justices are going. And Justice Gorsuch, it's a great question he asked counsel for the government. And he uses the example of a gummy, right? These CBD gummies that are everywhere. And he's saying, well, what if let's forget about the drugs in this case. And Hamani, I'm not quoting, right? But this is pretty much the question. He said, what if Hamani took one gummy bear to help him sleep every other day? Disarm him for life? Now that's a quote. You know, that's what he said. And the government attorney basically was forced to say yes under our theory, right? So one gummy bear every other night. Yup. That's a felony, right? And we're looking at up to 15 years. What do you think Justice Gorsuch is thinking about in this case, right? So sometimes you can kind of hear that. He also made an analogy, by the way, that I think got to the heart of the government's argument here about disarming drunkards. And he noted that John Adams used to drink a tankard of cider every morning, and that James Madison had a pint of whiskey daily. Yet they were not deemed dangerous, quote, habitual drunkards, right? And his question was, are they all habitual drunkards, you know, who'd be properly disarmed for life under your theory? So he really pressed the government on those cases. That's the stuff you're never going to hear in the story. And that's why it's really interesting to listen to the Q&A. Justice Barrett, I think, asked some really interesting questions about the logic, you know, underneath the statute, and you know, and she, you know, it's her job. She pressed the government with some hypotheticals about common, you know, medicines, right? So what if you take your spouse's sleep medication, Ambien? Right? Spouse has a prescription, ma'am. I'm going to take one night for whatever, right? Or what if I use Adderall, or you use Robitussin or testosterone without doctor's approval? Does that mean that I have now forfeited my gun rights? Right. Now Barrett noted that the law hinges on the drug's legal status rather than its effects, right? It's not the drug that's causing the dangerousness, it's the lawfulness. And does that make a lot of sense? Because somebody who's using Adderall off prescription, isn't going to be subject to the law in the same way that Hamani would. I guess on the flip side of that argument, Chief Justice Roberts, you suggested, that it would be, his quote was, it would be fairly cavalier, for courts to override Congress's determination that drug users are dangerous. And why do we know that? Well, it's Schedule 1, right? You know, this is a highly classified controlled substance. And so who are the judiciary, right? Why should judges second guess a categorical legislative judgment, right? So if Congress concludes, the way he put it, if Congress concludes that marijuana users are dangerous, who are we to question that? Well, that's like a fair observation. Very interesting things. Other thing that I'll note, because I do think it's also relevant as we think about how to apply these standards in local agencies, Justice Gorsuch, pointed out That the same administration that was pressing the prosecution in this case is also in the process of reclassifying marijuana from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3. Right? And, you know, doesn't that indicate that marijuana is less dangerous, right? I think what it really indicates is that marijuana has a medicinal purpose. And what it really, really indicates is that there's businesses that will secure tax advantages if marijuana is not Schedule 1, you know, and that's really why they're doing it. But I think it's a fair point. And in fact, the Justice Gorsuch called it an odd case to have chosen, right, for the government to be relying on this marijuana case when at the same time the administration is essentially indicating what all of us know, right, is that there are medicinal uses for marijuana, indicating that it's, you know, a less dangerous drug. One of the things that really wasn't, and so what's going to happen with that case? You know, I don't know, right? I have a pretty, you know, my sense is that they're going to strike down the law as applied to Hamani, and that, you know, the outcome is going to be that, you know, if you're not intoxicated and you're engaging in otherwise lawful use of at the state level of a substance, you're not going to be violating 922G3, right? And if the government tries to prosecute somebody for that, and there hasn't been a showing of intoxication, that prosecution is not going to go anywhere. You know, one of the things that is interesting in this case is that, and there wasn't a lot of exploration of this, and I thought there would be, is this question of who's an unlawful user, right? You know, because whether somebody's intoxicated or not, that's not in the statute. It doesn't say it's unlawful for an intoxicated person to possess a firearm. If it did, maybe we wouldn't have these questions. It says somebody who's an unlawful user of a controlled substance. Now, at the beginning of the podcast, I told you that we've got this 30-year-old ATF reg that defines an unlawful user as anybody who uses a controlled substance once in the past year. That seems pretty strict, right? You know, when most people hear that, go, gosh, you know, that's a 1997 rule. Is that a 2027 rule or a 2026 rule? And shouldn't things maybe change? Well, in addition to proposing and expediting the move, the proposed move of marijuana from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3, the Trump administration, just this January, this past January, ATF moved to update the definition of unlawful user, right? And so instead of this once in the last year, we're going to require evidence of a pattern of unlawful use. And so that's a little, it's also not perfect, right? But certainly it's kind of opening it up from the submission submitted by ATF with a little bit of their rationale. They said a couple of things that I thought were instructive. And one is, I'm going to quote, "This type of determination must be made based on evidence that indicates an individual regularly uses a controlled substance unlawfully." Unlawfully under federal law or under state law, regular use is not once. And so certainly they're trying to open it up so that you have these kind of one-off, you know, situations may not be ones where somebody is going to run afoul of 922G3. So I think that's wise. The other thing that I thought was interesting in their submission, another quote for you, and the ATF basically is talking about the denial of request to purchase guns by applying this standard. So they're talking about denials, and they say such denials create unnecessary constitutional questions. The prevailing opinion of many federal courts is that such denials are no longer supported under Section 922G3. So ATF knows what's going on out there, and they're basically acknowledging that there are some pretty significant constitutional questions that are raised by the standard that they use to process firearm applications. And that's the same standard that's adopted for federal prosecutions. And so that unlawful use definition, if that's changed or if that changes, that might make many of these things go away. And so, you know, to bring it all back, you know, I've been waiting for the Supreme Court to answer this question, you know, really since 2022. So we're 4 years down the road. This summer, the court's going to tell us whether 922G3 is constitutional or not. I think they're going to say it's not, at least applied in the situation in Hamani. And that's going to be the situation that a police officer or firefighter or correctional officer is going to find themselves in, right? Otherwise lawful use of marijuana, let's say, that shows up on a random test, right? So we have no evidence of impairment, no problem, no intoxication, but we have a police officer who takes a random, who pops out for marijuana, and you're in a recreational state and say, yeah, I have a gummy to help me sleep. Or you're in a medicinal, a medical marijuana state and you say, yeah, I've been prescribed marijuana to help me with my PTS. You know, is that person going to be fired or not? Or is that person going to lose their certification under their state law or not? I think if the court decides the case the way that I expect them to decide it, all of those actions are going to be based on an unconstitutional interpretation of a federal law, which means the rationale goes away. So what are law enforcement agencies going to do? That's a question. I'm not going to answer that for you, but that's a question that agencies are going to have to figure out. And as it relates to labor relations, which is what we talk about here, it's something that parties should be talking about at the bargaining table, whether your contract is up or not. My recommendation, if you're in a recreational marijuana state, there should be no random testing for marijuana. You can still test, but just don't count a positive as a positive. And if you're in a medical marijuana state, right? No random testing for marijuana. Or if you come up positive and you've got a medical marijuana card, that's not going to count as a positive. You know, even if you're not in a recreational state or a medical marijuana state, query why on earth you would apply these standards under random testing, because we know the way the law is going to go. So that's just my 2 cents. You might have 2 cents of your own. If you have a couple of cents or 3 or 4 or 5 cents, you can let us know in the comments. I think I've beaten this old horse into the ground. Hope this episode helped you guys with understanding this issue a little bit. It's a pretty interesting one. And we thought it warranted a full discussion this month. All right. And that's going to be about it. Next month, we'll talk about 3 or 4 cases of all kinds of different things. I'm going to purposely try to avoid cases that involve marijuana. Thanks a lot. I hope you guys have a great month. I hope you have a safe month. If you like the podcast, you know, like us, follow us, text to somebody, do the things that you do with podcasts. That's it. Rick Polson signing off. Talk to you later.